Paul Podcast Network.
Welcome to Arts on Air, a podcast featuring an eclectic mix of writers, artists, musicians, and other creative thinkers whose work explores dimensions of culture, spirit, community, and commitment. I'm Debbie Holton. Join me as I engage each about their own creative journey, their inspirations, and the one thing they feel is most important that we must know. Welcome. Welcome to episode 2. Today we'll hear from John Briggs, best known as a science writer, who's also a fiction writer and essayist. His latest book is entitled Trickster Tales, a Collection of Stories. He's the author and co-author of several nonfiction books on aesthetics and physics, including Fractals, The Patterns of Chaos, Fire in the Crucible, Seven Life Lessons of Chaos, Turbulent Mirror, and Metaphor, The Logic of Poetry. John is senior editor of the Connecticut Review and is a distinguished professor of English and coordinator of the writing program at Western Connecticut State University. He's also a founding fellow of the Black Earth Institute. That's where I first met John. I was quite taken by not only his discussion of chaos theory, but also his amazing photographs that you'll hear him talk a little bit about later in the podcast. I caught up with him this past March at the AWP conference held in Atlanta this year. It was a very cold and wet day, and so over coffee, well, I had hot chocolate. We got a chance to connect about his work, and I asked him about the events or themes that kept coming up in his life that led him to being a chaos theorist in the first place, and of course, a writer. Let's hear what he has to say.
Yeah, I think themes would probably be the relevant word for me, anyway. I think as a young person, because my parents were both musicians, I am not, but also in the psychologies. My father's a psychiatrist, my mother's a psychologist. So there's a certain analytical element to that, and that divide in my brain between the analytical and the artistic, and maybe say a little more about the artistic, but the sense of the universe as being something unknowable, let's say, or mysterious and evocative, as opposed to a universe being made out of things that you can understand and put into categories and so on. That was actually kind of a psychological crisis for me for a long period of time, and I knew I was attracted to writing, and I started out really writing poetry. Wasn't writing science or essays as a teenager, and writing poetry was being inspired by falling in love and the kinds of things that adolescents go through, where you're being confronted with feelings that you can't get to the bottom of, and you're in a household where talking about those things analytically is the coin of the realm. So that it became a kind of initially, I think, a struggle. Over a lifetime, I've made an advantage out of it, I think, and am now quite interested in the kind of intersection between science, for one thing, and aesthetics. So that's been a major theme in my science writing, is what I think I bring to the thinking and writing about science is the perceptions of a poet. Years ago when I taught down at the New School, this must have been in the late 70s when chaos theory was just coming into being. I taught a course in quantum mechanics and chaos theory for mostly art students at Parsons School of Design, and they got it right away, and they got it because science had gotten to the point where it was really looking at the universe in the way that artists look at the universe, and that was the message that I was conveying. So, you know, I was able ultimately to find that intersection between the two, but it was not an easy move. The process that I went through, which took probably 15 or 20 years till I got to the point where I could actually write something in fiction or in poetry, but I tended to focus on fiction that was real and not some construct. And the reason I say construct is that I committed the approach or the error that I think many writers do, which is one way that I put it now is writing about an idea or trying to is if you were to write the way critics critique. You know, critics look at works as if authors had a certain kind of intentionality, which was an intellectual intentionality. The opposite approach is sometimes to think of the writers as having no intellect whatsoever, and they're just Rorschach blotters of emotion. And the truth is that writers use their intellectual abilities very, very strongly, but they use it in a particular way that is not like the way critics use their analytical skills. So part of it was learning that difference and being able to give oneself to the paradox, one of many paradoxes, that you can both know the universe or your subject matter and not know it at the same time, and that to honor it is to honor both what you can know about it and what you can't know about it. And that may not be a specific thing. It may be just the sense that when you're using categories and words, those things tell you something about it, but you better be careful not to believe in them too completely, because then you end up falsifying the very thing that you're talking about. And none of that is particularly easy, because the consensual world, the world of the common language that we use, is a world that values and functions on stereotypes of all kinds. And I'm not arguing that those are not useful. They are useful to know what a chair is and to know what a tree is useful. But as Eric Fromm pointed out, you know, to know that the tone of the word tree is to run the risk of passing by a tree and not looking at it because you think you know what it is. And he says if you stop and really look at a tree, you realize you have no idea what this thing is, and it begins to penetrate you, and you begin to have an interaction with it. You begin to realize that there's some sense in which you are the tree, and so on. All of that is very difficult, or I found for me it was very difficult to sort that out, so that I could actually do the work. and you could see probably just in my talking about it that there's a lot of theoretical and intellectual process that goes on in me. That's kind of who I am, there's no point trying to deny that. I have to kind of work through it to get to something that's deeper than that.
I've seen your beautiful photographs that capture the aesthetic essence within a form, as you say, that you think you know, but you could, if you don't stop and really attend to this image, you are really you're at a loss, or it's your loss, because this looking at it from an entirely different way is what I think you have a way of bringing out this.
And my argument would be that everyone has a vision that, and if you think about it, that each of us sees the universe in a way that is absolutely unique and that we don't have a language for. If we did have a language for it and could communicate to somebody else, the paradox, one of the other paradoxes, would be that they would see that they see that too, that it's they understand it that way too. So any writer that you can name that we still read is a writer who has found a place to, found a language to convey something that is universal, found a particular language to convey the universal. And that's a very powerful notion, I think. It's not original to me. Goethe, among many others, described the idea that the universe is whole, but the only way you can find out about it, that wholeness, is through individual things, and that each individual thing is a microcosm from its own direction of that whole thing. And it is, there's no question that it is difficult to find that language, and it takes a long time, I think, for almost everybody. Even people who appear to get it right away usually run up against some barrier that really that they have to work through to get to the place where you can really convey to someone else what is at the same time very particular way of looking at things and is universal. Now the photography is interesting. I've been my latest passion with photography is to take pictures of clouds. And my favorite places to take pictures of clouds are shopping malls, because they're open, they're large open spaces. And obviously, doesn't work with the clouds that are right on the horizon, but the ones that are up a little, you get great views. And the thing about clouds is that, you know, everybody sees them. The clouds have an impact that is subliminal, I think, on people, sort of a sense of spirit or uplift. But we don't really look at them, and they're clouds after all. We might say, oh, they're pretty or whatever. But to really take a picture of a cloud, and I have a very strong zoom lens, a 350-millimeter lens that I can go right in, and I can focus on a particular part of the cloud that contains the dynamics. Clouds are what are called fractal shapes. That is to say that each part of the cloud is a kind of a microcosm of what's going on in the whole cloud. So that if you focus in, you can really begin to see it and not get lost in the fact that the cloud is part of the horizon and is part of the larger landscape. And those clouds are stories. Each one is a different story. I've started now taking sequences of clouds, so that you can see how a cloud unfolds and changes and becomes something else. There are clouds that chase each other across the sky and eat each other, and you know, fairy tales. I mean, just absolutely wonderful. And it's there, you know, it's there for everybody. And you know, once you show people that it's there, you know, I have friends of mine who are out, you know, now taking pictures of clouds. And you know, that's great. You can never take enough pictures of clouds. There are always more to take. Trees, a whole series of what I call trickster faces in trees. And there's recently a scientific article pointed out that our brains are wired to see faces, so we'll see faces in all kinds of things. One way to look at that is a poetic way to look at it, that our ability to see faces in other things means that we are seeing a relationship between ourselves and that thing that we're looking at, which means that the cloud, if I'm seeing forms in these clouds that are like forms in my imagination, then I'm no longer separated from, you know, that cloud by the word cloud. It's no longer just a category or an object or something that passes through my exterior world. It is now part of my interior world. It's reflecting my interior world. And that's the kind of, you know, that's, I think, where artists, writers, are. And there are, you know, as many ways as there are human beings to get at that connection.
You're listening to Arts on Air on the DePaul Podcast Network.
One of the things I've found in one of my interests is in creativity. Mm-hmm. And a psychologist colleague and I have developed a model of creativity which says, in effect, that because of the way we have to interact with life, we develop complexes, positive complexes and negative complexes, which are basically kind of feedback loops. They're habitual ways of behaving in the world and reacting to things that are presented to us. Perception has a certain habitual quality to it. And that's perfectly necessary, inevitable. Sometimes often, unfortunately, those complexes end up getting in our way. They make us paranoid, or they make us afraid, or they make us overconfident, or, you know, whatever it is. But there's another kind of line in our psyche that is our creative path, our creative personality, our creative being. And that line is free. So no matter how psychologically tied up you might be, if you do creative work, in that creative work, you're free. Now, this is different from the way most people look at creativity, and traditionally creativity has been looked at as a stepchild of your psychology. And so, in fact, there are the romantic view, psychological view of creativity is that you have to be crazy in order to be creative, and there are all kinds of equations that are made between being bipolar or schizophrenic, or, you know, and the crazier you are, the more of a genius you are. We think that's completely wrong.
More antisocial you are.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. You name it. I mean, mm-hmm. that's a stereotype that's embedded in most people's understanding of creativity. We don't think it works like that at all. We think that when you're creative, you in effect set aside your the knots and twists in your psychology. You may even use them as a subject matter, but you're more directly connected to the creative flow of energy that makes forms in the universe, that makes forms in nature. Mm-hmm. So there's a healing effect that automatically comes when you engage in creative activity. So taking pictures of clouds, if I'm in a bad way, if I take pictures of clouds, I'm out of it for that moment. For those moments, it's not a distraction. It's not like watching television. I'm interacting with the universe in a way that emphasizes the fact. I mean, one of the things I would say is Virginia Woolf has this seminal moment when she was 5 years old, or maybe younger, where she remembers hearing waves crashing on a beach where her parents went at St. Ives, and she says something to the effect of I had this feeling it's a miracle that I am here. And it seems to me that if you started with just that idea that it is remarkable that we should be here, and go from there. I mean, that's not to say that it's remarkable in a good way or a bad way, or it just is remarkable that we are here. You can take that idea, that sensation, it's really a sensation, and go into science. You can take it and go into art. You can take it and realize your connection to everything else. You can take it and realize your separation from everything else. Mm-hmm. You know, that's kind of a seminal moment, and you had suggested to me that I should think about what one thing you would like I would like people to take away, and I there would probably be something like that, that that is remarkable that I'm here, and it's remarkable that any of us is here, and that that's something to start with as a way of thinking about the world.
It's almost a prayer.
Yeah, yeah.
I did ask John how we could find out more about his work.
Probably the easiest way to do it is just to Google my name.
Okay.
And you'll discover all kinds of interesting different things. I have a website at WCSU, which is people.wcsu.edu/BriggsJ. You can get to my website there. But there's lots of other stuff that's just out there.
I want to thank you so much, John, for speaking with us today, and wish you well.
Thank you.
My guest for this episode has been John Briggs, who has talked with us about creativity, chaos theory, and clouds.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Arts on Air.
The theme music you hear, Cherimoya Groove, was produced by Debbie Wood-Holton and Arnold Graham. Special thanks go to Bob Rottenberg in the Anthropology Department, DePaul University.
If you'd like to contact me, Debbie Holton, please send me an email. I'd love to hear from you. You can find me at artsonair@gmail.com. I hope you'll join us next time on Arts on Air, the DePaul Podcast Network. Bye-bye.